Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. In this show, what we do is that we get people from different parts of the world, and we talk about what's been happening in their country or region, and get views and opinions and takes from different cultures and backgrounds. That's what we do. That's what we try to do. I'm Patrick Beja. I am from France originally, but currently residing in Finland. And I'm very glad to be welcoming back to the show Bart Buschutz, but damn it. originally from Belgium, still Belgian, but currently living in Ireland where he has no voting rights.
That is a very good summary indeed, Patrick. we've settled as a family on Buschutz. Pretend it's like B-O-O-S-H-O-T-S.
All right.
But Buschutz. Really, as anyone who speaks Dutch knows, it's actually Buschutz. But English people cannot say the S-C-H sound, so we've given up.
All right, Buschutz. And so you're in Ireland, as I mentioned, and I'm also very happy to be welcoming for the first time Mohamed Benchekroun from Morocco. How's it going, Mohamed?
Hi, everyone. Thank you for your invitation. I'm very happy to be with you, all of you. So yes, I am in Morocco currently. I am a professor in China. I am officially based in China. So, but the circumstance of the COVID-19 obliged me to stay and to be confined in my country, close to my family. So it's a good news to be close to my family in my country.
So how long, actually, that's a good point to start from. When did you have to leave China? At the start of the crisis?
Yeah, so it's during the Chinese New Year. So it's the holiday in China. So I took this opportunity to go to Morocco to enjoy some couple of weeks with my family. So once I have arrived in Morocco on January 18, I have been aware about this epidemic because, to be honest, in China, we have been aware and we have been informed about this pandemic of COVID-19. So it's only when I have arrived in Morocco that my friends told me about this.
Really? So, and,
yeah, of course. So all the measures that Chinese government, Morocco, took to close their borders, so it obliged me to continue my working online with my students. So from since January 18, I'm still in Morocco confined, and I'm not in this capacity to go back to China.
Of
but
course.
I'm very happy to be, as I told you, to be with my family confined, because it's a tough moment, and it's very hard to have the solidarity and the psychological support from the parents.
I can imagine that if you had stayed in China without knowing, there might have come a point where you couldn't have gone back to Morocco, and you would have had to stay in China for a longer period of time. So in a sense, yeah. I guess it was lucky that you planned to go to Morocco for the vacation.
Yeah, exactly. So as you said, I'm very lucky to leave this very hard challenge that touch all the places in all around the world in my country. But still, Morocco didn't surpass this this health of emergency, and we are still struggling to try to find a solution and to figure out and to overcome this this pandemic.
Yeah, we can talk about this in a little bit. Actually, my understanding was that Morocco wasn't too badly impacted, but maybe I misunderstood that. I do have a question about the communication in China, though. You said that within China, people weren't made aware of the extent of the epidemic. Meaning, I don't know where you were living, but to be honest, I have very little knowledge of the geography of China, so I wouldn't know how far it is from Wuhan or anywhere. But the people in Wuhan were under lockdown, so they knew what was happening. But people outside, are you saying that people outside of China were more aware of the conditions of the epidemic than people inside China in other parts of the country?
Yeah. The Chinese government has said that the pandemic has been discovered in the middle of December, and that has been confirmed by all the scientists and the experts who has followed this case. So, but when I was in China until January 18, nobody around me, neither my colleagues, my workmates, my friends, my wife, nobody has been aware about this about this virus. So probably the Chinese government wanted to mask and to hide this information, because they have pretended at the time that they would have this capacity to surpass and to control this virus very easily. But they didn't expect that it will be internationalized and touch all around the world. So as I told you, it's until I arrived in Morocco that my friends told me, explained me that I was lucky to be in Morocco, because an epidemic has affected Wuhan and the region of the Hubei. So I am based in, I live in Ningbo, so it's located at the east coast of China. So it's 1 hour from by train to Hangzhou, and 2 hours by train to Shanghai. So it's a literal city. I think 3 hours by plane to Wuhan. So the lockdown has been made only regionally in the Hubei province. In Ningbo, we have been averagely affected. So I can tell you that it's true that I have been informed about this about this virus. Yeah. Yes.
That's really interesting, because I seem to remember that by mid-January, we were aware of the issues in Wuhan. I might be misremembering, but I'm pretty sure. But as you said, it was the news traveled internationally, but inside the country, it was not as it didn't spread because of the control of the Chinese government. That's an interesting tidbit.
We were definitely, I know for a fact, it was starting to be on our radar in January, because I had the misfortune of getting knocked off my bike on the 20th of January, and so I got 2 weeks at home while I recovered, and that was the big news story.
Right.
Will the virus spread, or will it be contained? Yeah. You know, can it be held in Wuhan?
Well, that would be a fascinating conversation to be had, something to explore for another episode. The way things went, and maybe the way things are managed in China. But for now, let's talk about more recent things. And first, I'm going to thank you again for being on the show, Mohamed. And since we're talking about the pandemic, I guess the big thing, both in France and Finland, is the fact that things are really going back to normal. I guess in France, we could talk about the rumors of a change in government, meaning the president is going to dissolve the government and reform it. This is a common practice midway through the presidency. It often happens in order to adapt to the current situation, maybe quell a little bit of the unrest or the frustration by some of the population. When a government is not very popular, it happens. Sorry, Bart?
So this is equivalent to what in the UK would be a government reshuffle, where
the
Prime Minister just basically changes all his ministers around, but there's no election or anything.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's a reshuffle. It hasn't happened yet, but it seems, you know, the kind of discussion and leaks that mean the government itself is leaking it so that people aren't shocked when it happens. But it hasn't happened yet, so I don't know that we can discuss it in great detail. But the overall news is, things are slowly going back to normal. The number of cases have been steadily decreasing, the number of deaths as well. Very much so in Finland. We were not too badly impacted right here in the country. And so I'm pretty sure that by now there are almost no cases. Let me check the COVID statistics that we have on Google. Very useful. You go to Google, you type COVID, and you have access to a lot of statistics. And new cases were usually under 10 per day in Finland. So that tells you how low it is. In France, I think we're in the hundreds usually per day, but that is... I'm sorry?
It's a big country, though, that compared to Finland population-wise. Maybe it's not as bad as it sounds.
It's definitely the thing that is striking is that, well, not striking. The thing to note is that it is much, much, much lower than it had been at the height of the crisis. And it has been very stable since, I would say, mid-May. And the number of deaths is relatively low. We have... often a few days where it was zero, a few days where it was a couple dozens. So it's definitely the impression is that it's starting to really be under control. And
I just looked at Ireland for today. So as of 7 p.m., so that's fresh off the press, 5 deaths reported today and 15 cases.
Right. Yeah, Ireland, looking at the stats, is completely... flat, so compared to all the other countries. Morocco seems to be having a very low number of deaths as well, although there is some spiking, it seems, in the past few days, and we'll get to that in just a second. But, of course, the one thing that is on everyone's minds as well is the situation in the U.S., which, if you didn't listen to it, I did an editorial-type episode last week talking about that and the responsibilities and, you know, my thoughts and the way we see the situation in the U.S., but it has certainly been, in the minds of people, you know, not at the front of our minds, but somewhere there, because it is so surprising that every single other country in the world, or Western country is at least, is managing to take it under control, to put it under control, and the U.S. isn't, for number of reasons, probably, I discussed in that editorial. But so overall, that is the thing that is the main thing. Things are getting better, and we seem to be getting a hold on the epidemic. Of course, it might flare up again at some point, and we're ready to do what needs to be done if it does. But it's pretty... I don't know. The storm has passed for now.
I'm still very nervous.
Oh, I mean, we're all very nervous, and we're very we're not declaring victory, but it's you know, the reality is that we're less oppressed by the situation than we were. Aren't you in Ireland?
Well, we're still in the process of rolling back our restrictions. We are not out of lockdown. The Irish government took a very sensible approach of doing a 4-phase ending of the lockdown with 3 weeks between each phase. So it takes 2 weeks until you're really sure what's happened. And then you have 1 week of data where you really know that you haven't made a catastrophic mistake. So we're in stage three or four. Mm. So we're actually, every 3 weeks, it's really nervous for us as we figure out whether or not what we've just changed is successful. So on Monday, just a few days ago, the pubs reopened for the first time. And that, I have to say, has me extremely nervous.
Do you know if you have a good test and trace system?
Our tests are certainly up to snuff, and for the moment, our tracing is able to cope.
Okay.
The question is, if reopening the pubs causes a big spike and our tracing gets overwhelmed, then we're in trouble.
Go back to lockdown. That's what happens. True. Or you selectively.
And the other big debate. The other big debate here that has me very worried is there's a really strong push to go from 2 meters social distancing to one. And that is half as effective. And as someone with a pre-existing condition who's married to someone with an extremely serious lung condition, the cavalier attitude, we're basically profit before people, it makes me spectacularly nervous.
You know, it's really interesting that you're saying this with the significantly lower number and even percentage in your country. It seems you're faring really well, and still you're very nervous. But
nervous because our health system came close to breaking point spike, right? So we got a good look at what happens if we lose control. Mm. And right now we have control. I'm just worried that there's a lot of people getting very complacent very quickly. And I'm afraid we're going to lose the control we have. And like California, we're going to go from an example of how it should be done to, oh my God, what have you idiots done?
Well, I think it was the same in France. And for some reason, I might be wrong, but it was really, we were badly hit in France. But it seems now that we have it under control and we understand what can happen and what we have to do if it does. So, you know, it's like we were saying, that's my feeling, like we were saying at the beginning of all of this, at the beginning, you had to explain social distancing to everyone. You had to convince people. Now, everyone understands, so we can go back to an effective lockdown by the majority of people. Of course, some idiots will always, not want to do it, but we can go back to an effective lockdown just like this.
And what about masks in your countries? Because the Irish seem absolutely fundamentally incapable of understanding the concept of wearing masks. The closest they seem to come is pretending they're Egyptian pharaohs and wearing them as little fake beards on their chin.
We're using masks. I want to go to Mohammed and ask how the situation is in Morocco. But the masks, some people don't want to wear them, but most people are okay with wearing them, I would say. But
So about Morocco, I think one of the positive one of the advantages about how the Moroccan government has managed this pandemic is that we had the self-sufficiency on producing the masks, because we have a large industrial base in textile, and the Ministry of Morocco has been very quick, very flexible to open the negotiation and to ask the entrepreneurs in this sector to convert their activity into producing the masks. So so the private sector in the textile have been received a large financial support on producing the masks. So in a short time, Morocco has been able to not only getting the self-sufficiency of the mask, but also been able to export. So Moroccan mask has been used also in Europe and in the Middle East. So this flexibility has been, it was a very positive point on how Moroccan government has managed. But the main reason is that
let me ask you a question about this. Do you remember when you started wearing masks? Because for us, since we didn't have enough, the government said, let's say masks aren't effective and keep them for the medical personnel. Mm-hmm. And it took like a couple of months, I would say, before we started using them and manufacturing them. Do you remember when it was?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't remember the exact date, but I can tell you the it's from the middle of May that Moroccan government has announced the obligation to wear the masks. But it's very hard to announce the obligation of the mask, but at the same time, the people cannot find it on the shop and in the pharmacy. So we wait until all the process could be flexible and could be very fluid in terms of processing, in terms of logistic, production, delivering, and to be able to be sold. And the good advantage also is that the price, the retail price, has been subventioned. Like, I think the retail
subsidized.
Price... Subsidized, yes.
Yeah.
So
okay.
The American government has covered a large part of the cost. So the Moroccan
affordable
people, independently from their social classes, have been able to wear and to buy the masks in their daily life.
A difference. Like we're still at the stage where the government are saying, please wear a mask on public transport and in shops. We're working on legislation to make it compulsory. We might have it next week. It's been months and we're only just thinking about making it compulsory here.
Yeah, well, I think in Morocco we have applied two kind of measures. The sensibilization, we have sensibilized and encouraged the people to show them the positive effect of wearing the mask in this capacity to prevent and to reduce the cases. But also at the same time, Morocco has established some sanctions to those who don't respect this rule. I think we have been in this both sides. And I think for those who don't wear the mask, they can be in jail for 3 months. I think Moroccan government has been very strict because they have been aware about the importance of wearing the mask in this prevention. Because in the Asian country, one of the reasons why Asian countries have more successfully managed these cases is that their population are used to wear the mask, and this wearing the mask have tremendously decreased the spread and the contagion of this virus.
Mm. Yeah, that's what we... It's really interesting that you're saying it started in mid-May because of logistics concerns, which essentially, I think, even in France, where there have been a big scandal about... people felt like the government lied to them about the masks in the beginning, in March, when the lockdown first started happening. The government was saying masks aren't effective, which, to be fair, was what the Western doctors thought, mistakenly, but thought at the time. And then, of course, it was a couple of months before we could get enough masks because China, which we had been contracted with to provide us with masks in case of an emergency, was not able to manufacture and send the masks. Obviously,
I think the politicians and the scientists made a lot of mistakes about the measures and what they thought about the virus, because this virus was new, very mysterious, very vicious. So I think it's very natural and normal that we can make a mistake. And what really honestly and objectively impressed me in Morocco is that we took generally good measures. For example, about the chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, Morocco was very clear about this point, is that Morocco has authorized the use of the hydroxychloroquine to the patient, and the result was very impressive, because the mortality rate in Morocco is very low, is around 0.5%, and one of the reasons is that the doctors have prescribed this medicine.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah, there's been a huge debate in France as well with a controversial figure, Professor Raoult, who's a well-known doctor and researcher, but who's also kind of he kind of is a, I don't know how to describe it. He's a, almost a troll. He's trollish in the way he approaches things. So there are a lot of people who don't like him and who don't trust him. And it's become a very big discussion. And to be clear, he was defending the use of hydroxychloroquine for a long time.
About
yeah,
that?
Go ahead. Of course.
The Didier Raoult didn't. He's not the inventor of the hydroxychloroquine. He just got this advice from the Chinese doctors who have used this hydroxychloroquine to the Chinese patients, and when they saw the effective results and the efficient results, so they have transmitted this recommendation to the old scientists. So Didier Raoult, just he has follow and internationalized this utilization of the hydroxychloroquine. So honestly, I don't understand why it was taken such a big debate in France, because when we saw the results, the scientists like Didier Raoult is one of the most successful, most known doctors in his field. So when he recommended, I don't know why it has created some controversial about this fact. And when we see the result, the reality was clear. Hydroxychloroquine was very efficient. If you see in Marseille is the city that has the lowest mortality rate in all the France territory. But the origin, it comes from the Chinese doctors who have recommended to use this medicine.
I think are we sure we're talking about the right drug? Because my understanding was that hydroxychloroquine was actually abandoned by the WHO because it was failing so spectacularly in its tests. Whereas there's the drug that's now been adopted in the UK that's doing much better, and the steroids. And I wish
that
I was better at names.
That is the the two of you are summarizing the entirety of the debate. There are some people who are adamant that it works very well. Didier Raoult is a strong defender of it. And to answer your question, Mohamed, the reason why it was so controversial is that a lot of people felt like Raoult was not observing the proper testing protocols to be certain that it could be used and that it was harmless, because it's still a drug that does have some severe unintended special effects. Special
on the
effects.
Heart. Like its effect on the heart is well known, and that's one of the things COVID attacks.
Yeah.
So my understanding of the science is that it's absolutely not clear cut. It's absolutely not the case.
And that's,
that it's
that's the issue. That's the problem, which is it could be, but at least the way I understand it, it could be effective for all we know, and it could be a better chance for people who are sick in spite of the undesired effects. But since the tests weren't done respecting all the protocols, we can't be sure, and it irks a lot of doctors. That's the way I see it. It's more of a method issue than a real efficiency issue. Mohammed,
there's also
go
the
ahead.
Potential of a conflict of interest, because it's a drug that's still under patent. So there's people playing fast and loose with science, not following the protocols properly, claiming it's successful without having the evidence, and they stand to make a vast fortune of money. So that makes me suspicious. If you're going to do this for profit, you really have to show me the science.
Yeah, but about what you said, Patrick, when we are living an emergency and the urgency and a lot of people die, we cannot wait until respecting all the protocol, because the medical protocol, it takes a long time until we find a solution to the medical issue. So Didier Raoult said, okay, we can apply this protocol, but while we find a solution, I have some way to save the life of the people. And that's why we cannot, when the people are sick, we cannot tell them just stay at home, isolate yourself, and just take Doliprane. It's not very reasonable. I'm not a scientist, but I think the recommendation of Didier Raoult, it's symptomatic of flexibility, of capacity to respond quickly to an issue, which are the essential qualities to be able to overcome a pandemic and the crisis, that's COVID-19. But of course, we have to respect the full protocol, the full process of medical process, but it takes a long time. While we find this solution, we have to save the life of the people.
Well, that's the problem,
Mohammed.
We don't know that it saves the lives until we've tested. And I'm not sure people, if the death rate is 3% without any medication, 3%. If the medicine you're going to give someone increases that death rate to 5%, it saves some, but some suffer from other effects and it increases it to 5%, you don't want to give the drug. If it decreases it to 1% or even to 2%, then you want to give the drug. But you don't know until you've gone through the tests. So it's very, and of course, there might be some cases in China and some Chinese advice or other advice, or maybe Raoult is right. I honestly don't know, but the reason why you don't want to give a drug and say, this disease isn't a disease that kills you 80%. You have an 80% chance of dying. So you might as well try this drug that you don't know if it's going to work, right? It kills you very... Go ahead.
I just want to jump in. Flexibility is very important, right? I agree with you, Mohammed, that you can't let things happen at the usual 5-year pace in the middle of a pandemic. That would be murderous. I mean, that would be horrible. But at the same time, the flexibility has to continue. So there was a point when the science was pointing towards hydroxychloroquine as having real potential, and that was a good, at that point in time, it's perfectly reasonable to push for it. But we now have two other drugs which seem to be at least as effective and do not have horrible side effects. So right now, our best guess right now, based on the limited evidence we have, is that we have two other drugs that are probably better than hydroxychloroquine. So if you're going to be flexible and say that we should adopt hydroxychloroquine when that was the only game in town, well, now it's one of three and the other two seem better. So that same flexibility should continue to apply. We should continue to update, keep taking the best guess based on the best evidence we have right now so that we save as many people as we can.
If you were ganging up on Mohammed a little bit, go ahead. You can.
Well, I'm not ganging up on Mohammed. I'm just making a point. It's kind of important.
I agree. I agree with you.
Yeah. I will just give you the example of Morocco. Before we prescript the hydroxychloroquine, when we analyze the curve of the recovered cases and the death cases, they increase equally, like. Every day, like when we have two deaths, we have two recovered. It was the statistic before using the hydroxychloroquine. But after that, Moroccan government has decided to use it. The curve of the recovered has been increased tremendously, and that's why we have this increase a lot in compare with the recovered. So the Moroccan cases is the experimentation that showed the efficiency part of the hydroxychloroquine in the curve of the recovered cases. I'm not a defender of Didier Raoult. I don't know him. I have no personal interest on defending him. I'm just tell you about the Moroccan experience. After Moroccan used the hydroxychloroquine, the recovered cases has been increased tremendously compared with the before using this drug. Mm.
All right. Well, I guess that is food for thought. So, we've been talking about the pandemic for a little bit here. It's definitely the news for France and Finland, I would say. Is in Morocco, is that also what you would qualify as the main piece of news? And maybe you can tell us, we've touched on it, but how things have been going in the past few weeks? It seems like you have very little cases and very few deaths.
If we have a little debt, I think the main reason is that Morocco has decided to close the borders very early. In March 13, Morocco decided to close the borders with the rest of the world only after knowing the few cases. I think after 10 cases, Morocco decided to close the borders. So, and we had this chance to see the experience of what happened in China and Europe and the United States. So from this benchmark method, I think we decided to use the quarantine method, the strict quarantine such similar as what has been made in the Hubei province in Wuhan, because all the shops has been shut down, everything. So during 3 months, I think Morocco has lived the longest
lockdown.
Quarantine, yeah, lockdown. During 3 months, the Moroccan people didn't be able to go out only for three reasons: for the health urgency, or for the food, for the survival need, or to go to the job. So, and also the university and the school has been shut down. So, and on the contrary, as you know, Morocco is not a developed country. So we have a lot of people who they cover their need in their daily work. So knowing this situation, the Moroccan government decided to give some direct help, the financial direct help to all the people who lost their jobs during this this COVID-19, and also the thing that really admires me is that the king of Morocco, when he made the call for the donation, all the rich people in Morocco decided to make some donation, and we have collected around $3 million. So this $3 million has been
used
focused
to help
on
the population.
Managing. Yeah, how managing the COVID-19 pandemic. So we about financing the survival need of the people, to buy the equipment, to buy the kit test, and all the stuff to be able to overcome the crisis. The other reason is that Moroccan people have received positively this idea to stay at home despite of the difficulty to stay very long time. And you know, in Morocco, our system is called the Mahzen, and this system is very successful, very efficient on managing the big crisis. I don't know if you remember in the Arabic Spring in 2011, Morocco was among the few Arabic countries who have overcome this crisis very peacefully rather than other countries. But the drawback of this system is that after return in normal, this system is not very rigid to accept the new competencies, the new skills. So this system is good on providing the stability, but very difficult on renewing their method, on accepting the new skills, the new way of managing the countries. So this system has positive side and bad side. And definitely during this crisis, during the pandemic, our system is very successful on that.
How much a part of that success was an education campaign from the government that managed to get trust of people? Was that part of the success?
And yeah, I'll add to that question, how much of it was education and how much of it was the strength of the government saying, you know what, that's what you're going to do, and if you're not happy, you're going to do it anyway. You know, kind of an, I don't want to say authoritarian, but, you know, the strength of the,
of course,
of the government.
Yeah, you can say it was authoritarian, but also in their education and in the pedagogy. We saw through the social media, through the TV, a lot of campaign about the importance to stay at home, to respect the rules, and to wear the mask and so on. But on the contrary, the Moroccan people know very well how the Moroccan system is running, how the Moroccan system manage, and they know the authoritarian part of the regime and of the system. A lot of people went to jail because they didn't respect the rules. So I think it's the hybrid system, is the equilibrium between the authoritarian part and the sensibilization, definitely.
Mm-hmm. How did the population... So we understand maybe they didn't have a, they were told, not asked, but how did the population react to all of this? It seems like, was it genuine, all right, I get it? Or were there still a lot of people who were saying, this is overreaction, I don't want to do it? Or how did, the population react?
At the beginning, the Moroccan people were shocked about the this... about the impact of the pandemic in our lives. So I think they, at the beginning, we accepted this decision of the lockdown because we thought that it was very beneficial, because we thought that Moroccan people, Moroccan government has prioritized the life of the Moroccan people rather than the economy and our liberty. So this was, we accepted. But after, progressively, the people start getting tired, and also the precarity and the poverty, because not all the families receive the help, the financial aid from the government. So progressively, we saw some revendication, some anger about the long time of this lockdown. That's why on June 10, the Moroccan government decided to liberate everything and to return in normal, and all the shops has been opened back by only covering 50% of the capacities. So at the beginning, yes, we accepted, but at the end, it was very difficult to live under the quarantine, definitely.
Yeah, I can imagine that, especially since the number of cases and the number of deaths in the country were so low, and the economic impact, as you were saying, you kind of mentioned it earlier, you were saying a lot of people live day to day, meaning they get their income for that day or that week's exactly. needs. So the economic impact is huge when you don't have any savings. And but overall, it seems like the way it went aligns kind of strangely well with the way it happened in Western Europe. It feels like the dates fit kind of well. Maybe there's, you know, a couple of weeks extra here, or a couple of weeks less there. It seems to be quite similar in the way it evolved. Bart, you were going to say something?
Well, I'm just curious what the balance is between trust and fear. You know, is it a case that a lot of people trusted the government's advice, or is it a case that they were very scared, or is it a little from column A and a little from column B?
I think generally speaking, Moroccan people, they have a low belief on the Moroccan government, but they have a strong belief in the king Mohammed VI. So when the Mohammed VI decided to launch these measures, the Moroccan people have accepted, despite of the difficulty to stay at home, because once again, we are not a developed countries. We can find 10 people living in the small room with not the necessary the necessary comfortable environment to be able to stay for so long time. That's why after 1 month, after 2 months of the lockdown, the people getting tired, the people found the excuse to go out without a real reason. So we can say at the beginning it has been addressed, but gradually, I think the fear take the advantage on the trust, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. No,
the fact that the king is serving an important role is very interesting, because that's obviously something that we don't have an equivalent of in Ireland, Finland, or France.
Yeah, indeed. I guess, of course, we could talk about all of this for much longer, but I do want to ask what is happening in Ireland, and you promised me it wouldn't be about the COVID-19.
Indeed. I think the last time I was talking to you, we had just had an election with a fascinating result where we basically ended up with three parties that were about the same size as each other and no group of two. So any two of those would have to be involved in a government to get above 50% of the seats, right? When you have three parties that have basically got close to, say, a quarter of the vote each, and then some small parties picked up the rest. How do you form a government if at least two of those don't want to talk to each other? And we had Sinn Féin, who are basically the political arm of the IRA. They would say that they've evolved from that origin, but that's certainly their origin story. And they're kind of considered a little bit toxic, and people don't want to do business with them. They're also extremely left-wing and, what some would argue, unrealistic in their economic policies. And then you have two parties who are both centre-right Christian Democratic parties who on paper look like they should agree perfectly with each other. Their policies are almost indistinguishable, but they were on opposite sides of the Irish Civil War 100 years ago, and so they refused to do business with each other.
I do want to mention...
They've gotten over it. After 100 years, they've gotten over it. Oh, wow.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I do want to mention before you keep going, and this is... the unexpected twist. For those who don't remember, the last time you were on was on the last episode of the Brexit saga. It was episode 4. And it was essentially, we titled it The Reckoning. So as we joked, I can't remember if it was on air or before we started recording, but it was back in a time when the biggest thing we had to worry about was Brexit. And that was a really big thing. I don't know if I would like to go back to that time, but it certainly seems far away. But
it's creeping back on our agenda because the deadline for not crashing out is now sneaking up on us. We're halfway through the summer already. We're into July, and the negotiations are really far behind. And if we've passed the point where they can say, give us another year, so they're leaving at the end of this year with or without a deal. And I'm not seeing much sign of a deal. So we may be having a reckoning Mark II in a few months' time. But anyway.
All right. So the two parties have made up.
They have made up. They have agreed because they're extremely close in terms of seats in Parliament. 37 versus 35, which isn't enough to get them to the magic number of 80, which is a majority. So they've had to invite in some friends. So the Green Party have joined two centre-right parties to form the Irish government.
Actually, I'm going to interrupt you again to say that we actually had a municipal election in France. It was delayed by the COVID, or the second turn was delayed, but it was essentially a green wave. A lot of green parties got into mayorships in the country, and that also has to do with the reshuffle of the government. But
Yeah, so one of the biggest obstacles actually in getting a government agreed. So once the two civil war parties had agreed they could work with each other after all, the next thing was they had to go get either the left wing parties or the Green Party on side with centre right. And in the end, they got the Greens. And the big sticking point was a commitment to 7% per annum reduction of greenhouse gases. And that really, really is what almost stopped the government forming. The Green Party would not back down on that. 7% every year for the lifetime of the government.
Wow, that's impressive. And so they agreed.
Yeah. They've agreed. So that we have a new government. We have a prime minister, or a Taoiseach as we call them, for 2.5 years from Fianna Fáil. And then 2.5 years from now, they will swap. And the other centre-right party leader will become the prime minister for 2.5 years. And then we're due an election.
It will be interesting to see how it works out and how much one blames the other for messing things up in the end. So I have a couple of questions going back to Mohammed. The first one is only partially related to Bart, but it's about Brexit. I'm just wondering, maybe not yourself, but in the Moroccan population, is that something that is, you know, well known, a concern, or is it so far away that people don't care about the Brexit? And the other thing is, how concerned with the green matters and the ecology is the Moroccan population?
Okay. About the Brexit, I think the Moroccan people in general are not very well concerned, or it's not their cup of tea to follow what's happening specifically in the UK, because as you know, we are Arabic and French-speaking country, and we are more focused on what's happening in Africa, Middle East, and also in the French part of the world. But the elites, in Moroccan elites, of course, definitely will follow closely what's happening in the Brexit. And for us, it's also an opportunity for Morocco to establish a cooperation with the UK. And 2 weeks ago, I got the chance to be one of the keynote speakers with the British ambassador in Morocco, and we talk about the opportunity to welcome the foreign direct investment from British to Morocco, because Morocco now has created the industrial base to welcome the foreign investments in order to export it, whether in Africa or Europe or United States, because Morocco is considered as the gateway. So I think we have we have this opportunity to be closer and closer with the UK. But generally, as a part of that, the Moroccan people in general, they are not very well known, very well aware about what's happening in the in the UK, I guess. Yeah.
I see. Yeah, it seems like the Brexit for us, we look at it as a catastrophe for everyone, but it does open opportunities for other types of trade cooperations. And I'm sure it's happening in a lot of
particularly
countries.
Particularly Africa, actually, Kenya and those kind of countries, particularly actually former British colonies, are like, ooh, let's refresh those relationships in a positive way. It's interesting, actually, that the French-speaking parts of Africa are also seeing the opportunity and grabbing it with both hands.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think, in my opinion, I think the Brexit is just a result of such of the desire from the people to get back their sovereignty, like because the election of Donald Trump or the election of the president in Brazil and what's happening in the Brexit, it's just the new trend of the desire from the people to take back their sovereignty. And and I think the COVID-19 will be the accelerator of this trend, because I don't know if because the developed countries understood their full dependence on the supply chain from China. When you see like France, which is the fifth most powerful economic country, who haven't in their hand the self-sufficiency of wearing the mask, and they were waiting until the Chinese mask arrived in their land. It was a disaster and a kind of humiliation. So this COVID-19 will aware. It's awareness of the urgency that to relocalize a part of the industries in the land of the countries, and to get back the sovereignty. And when you see like why Asian countries have been more stronger and they have struggled more efficiently than Western countries, because they have this political sovereignty and industrial sovereignty to face this COVID-19. So I think what's happening in the Brexit could be and has this possibility to be extended in the rest of the Europe. I think so.
I mean, there is certainly a desire for sovereignty and for independence, but the way we're looking at it, at least from France, and we'll see how it you know, how it goes in the rest of the EU, it is the idea that we need to get sovereignty and independence back in the EU, not in each individual country. But it's a very much a strong approach of, yeah, the industrialization that tapered off in the EU, we need to bring that back to an extent, to at least to be able to weather crises like this independently. And go ahead, Bart.
Sorry. Well, no, I think there's actually two forces that work at the same time, right? So there is definitely a desire to become economically less. All of our eggs are in one basket, right? The whole world had put all of its eggs in one basket, and everyone was working off the idea of just-in-time production. So we got rid of our expensive stockpiles of medical equipment because the answer is we'll just order it just in time. And that works absolutely fine if every country's crisis happens at a different time. But of course, this didn't come like that. We all ended up looking for masks at the same moment in time, and all of us had just-in-time ordering, and all of us were ordering just-in-time from the place the pandemic started. Talk about putting all of your eggs in one very shaky basket. But at the same time, there's a really strong urge to put cooperation in terms of medical science, in terms of other sorts of cooperation. So I'm seeing both a desire to become more self-sufficient again and a desire to become more collaborative and cooperative internationally as well at the same time. Like, both forces seem to be happening together, which is interesting.
But I think about the Brexit, I think this decision to be separated from the United Nations as an institution is not to it's a desire to get this sovereignty, but at the same time to be opened to the world, is to establish the multilateralism relationship.
Honestly, I don't know if the Americans, the English people who voted for Brexit, I don't think that was on their mind. Maybe it was. Maybe I'm wrong.
I do, Patrick. No, Patrick, it was. I call it former colonial syndrome. There was a time when Britain ruled the world and it's romanticized.
Oh, in that sense. Okay.
And by being just a member of the European Union, they're not a major player on the world stage. But, you know, glory days will come again and we will set off and become this major world power. That was an emotion that was played on. I'm not saying it's realistic. It's an emotion that was pulled, the heartstring.
Who knows? It might work. It maybe they're going to start having trade relations with every country in the world, and they're going to be more free to have better deals. And maybe. I mean, they're starting to talk with Morocco, it seems. That's a start.
Takes time, though. Trade deals take 5, 6, sometimes 12 years. The big Europe-Canada deal was 12 years in the making, I believe. Yeah. They have a lot of work to do.
Sorry, we interrupted you, Mohammed.
No, I would like just to clarify one thing, because I also follow what's happening in the Europe. The defenders of the European Union institution, they say that if you want to stay stronger with China in the East and United States at the West, we have to create this union to unite the forces of the all European countries to be able to have one voice and very strong voices and to impose their desire and to be able to establish the balance between the geopolitical forces. But the main difference between Europe as a continent and United States and China is that China is a country, is one country, and it has been historically one country. Same as United States, but Europe is not a nation, is not a federalism of nations, is a country, is a civilization of different countries they have a lot of similarities culturally, in terms of religions, in terms of philosophy, in terms of how we perceive the world, but they have a lot of divergence that really create these obstacles to create this federalism of the federalism of European countries. But this project is very noble in the paper, but very difficult to apply it, knowing these specificities that I have mentioned, I think.
Oh, I completely agree. It's very, very difficult well to apply. Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't mean, I mean, in my, I'm very much pro-European, so I think it is still the better way to go for a number of reasons. But I completely agree. It's super difficult to apply. Even in the US, where I think arguably there are more differences between some states than there are between European countries. Of course, there is a common shared history. That means there's unity when in Europe, it's much more difficult to build. So, yeah, I agree.
There's an American identity that supersedes, like an American has a state identity and an American identity. They're a proud Texan or a proud Floridian or a proud Arkansian or whatever.
I don't know how proud the Floridians are right this minute, but yes, I get
it. No, but you know what I mean, right? There's an identity there where they have two flags that they feel strongly towards. Yeah, and in Europe, we have our Irish, our French, our Finnish, but we don't have a strong European identity.
Yeah,
it may be developing, but it's not strong. It's not like in America.
It's very new. It's very new. Anyway, all right, last question, and then we're going to end the show about the ecological aspects of well, everything in Morocco.
Yeah, Morocco is one of the leaders on the ecology in Africa and also in the world, because we have, as you know, 50% of our territory is a desert, so we have implemented. I think the second largest solar panel in the desert, so which will cover in 2025 40% of our electricity. So
wow.
Definitely one of the biggest strategy of the Moroccan government under the political want from the king is to orient Morocco to be one of the leaders on the ecology. So all and our biggest universities have created a research development department focused on to find innovation, to innovate on at this field. And we can say that it's something that has been launched under the vision of the king Mohammed VI. So this is something that we can perceive it, and it's one of the biggest investment, because achievement under the reign, I thought, if you can say this in English, under the reign of Mohammed VI.
Interesting. It seems you're really painting a really nice picture of Morocco. If it wasn't for the risk of going to jail for 3 months for not wearing a mask, I think I would like to be there right now. Although
you are welcome to, you know, Morocco is known as a welcoming countries. We are very the world know us as we are very we have this hospitality to welcome the foreign people. That's why we are touristic countries. Every year we receive 13 million tourists. That's why, you know, this COVID-19 has impacted very significantly our economy, because we are very dependent on the foreign tourists. And when Morocco decided to close the borders, it has been a disaster for this sector. But honestly and objectively, I'm not a propagandist of Morocco. I'm just want to. Of course, we have a lot of drawbacks. We have a lot of poverty to cover. We are not very advanced in terms of education in our healthcare sectors. We have a lot of social disparities. As I told you at the beginning, a lot of people they have to gain their daily expenses daily. So we have a lot of challenges to face. But definitely, I can assure you that our stability, our unity, under the vision of Mohammed VI, we are on the way to overcome this challenge. And to go forward the category of the emergent countries.
Bart, you had a question.
Yeah, no, it's just by pure coincidence. I was listening to a podcast about cooking recently, and the guest was in Marrakesh, where they run culinary tours, where basically you come to Marrakesh and they take you around the markets and hidden away restaurants and things that tourists would never find. And they insisted that to prove how welcoming Morocco is, they said that there's no word in Moroccan for tourist. The closest they have is a word that means guest of the king. Is that true, or is that a good way of looking at the hospitality?
Sorry, I didn't follow your question. Can you repeat, please? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Basically, what they were saying is that in Morocco, the word for tourist translates as guest of the king.
No.
Oh, it sounded really good. It made Morocco sound wonderful. I'm sorry to hear that.
No. We don't qualify the tourists as the guests of the king. I think we qualify the tourists as the foreigners who want to spend a good time in our countries, and we are very lucky to welcome them, because it's one of the way to enrich our country economically, and it's one of the diplomacy to give a positive image of Morocco.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for this explanation. Bart, is there anything you want to say before we close off the show?
I just want to thank Mohammed, because I'm sorry to say, as a silly foreigner, the stereotypes of Morocco that I would have picked up were not in any way useful, as most stereotypes aren't. So it was really nice to have a more nuanced understanding, so I can finish this podcast understanding Morocco better than I did when I started. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. The stereotypes are everywhere when we... I think the best way to break and to overcome the stereotype is to go to the other, to accept the different, and to understand, because finally we are all belonging to the same civilization, which is the human civilization, and we have the same desire, which is to live with dignity, happiness, and justice.
What a great way to end a podcast.
That I will end on that, exactly. Thank you very much, Mohammed. Before we do completely close it off, though, I would like to ask both of you to tell us where we can find you on the internet, if you have a Twitter account, for example, or something else. Bart, why don't you start?
Okay. Since no one can spell my surname, I would suggest you go to bartb.ie and then click the appropriate button for Twitter or whatever it is you'd like to find, because at least that way you can probably spell Bart.
Excellent. You know, I will include the link to your Twitter account in the show notes. So if that's the place you want people to go, it will be there.
Well, that's the only social media I do, to be honest. I don't do Facebook or any of that kind of stuff. So yes, my Twitter is definitely the best place to send people.
Mohammed, do you have a Twitter account or something else you
want to? Among the social medias, I'm very active on Facebook. So you can type my name, Mohammed Ben Shkron, so you can find my my picture. And I'm very active through via this social network. I'm also active on the Instagram and LinkedIn, but not on Twitter.
All right, I'll include the link to your Facebook. That's probably the best. The best one, and of course your name will be in the show notes as well.
Thank you.
All right, and for me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and you can find this show at frenchspin.com if you want to comment or tell us about anything, really. You're very welcome to do so, frenchspin.com, and of course, the Phileas Club is made possible by the sponsors at Patreon, patreon.com/thePhileasClub. The link will also be in the show notes, so please feel free to venture there and maybe support us if you like what you heard and hear every month on the show. Thank you very much.
I'm going to jump in, Patrick, because you're never going to do this yourself. You're never going to praise yourself. I'm going to praise you and say that the new podcast you're doing with Tom Merritt, Work Insanity, is amazing, and it has helped me keep my sanity during COVID. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. This is a show we do about working from home. It's every Monday, and it's about 15 minutes, and it's tips about working from home. It's very easy to find. It's Work Insanity, an excellent pun that I don't mind telling you I came up with. So.
Well done, because it stuck in my head immediately. I did not have to ask the name of the show twice. I thought it was very funny, so thank you.
Thank you, Bart. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back in a few weeks. Oh, or maybe actually I might be on vacation the French way for several weeks, so maybe back in August. Talk to you then. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.